kiss your lips a thousand times, and more times than I can count. I have called you mine, you have stood by me in my
life. From New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. On the road, have a lot to share. Five foods to keep your eyes healthy. Grape-enriched diets support eye health. Or tanning even without burning increases the risk of melanoma. Flame retardants during pregnancy are as bad as lead and can lower your child's IQ. Toxins in the environment might make you older than your years. And can Tai Chi slow the aging process? Those are just some of the things, but a lot more on health and healing and living a longer life. A large segment from the environmental section today, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. It's a Thatcherite revolution. There is no such thing as free trade. Instead, it's actually corporate plunder and the war on the working people. From Colin at Todd Hunter, we'll be sharing that with you from Global Research. By the way, we should be opposed to both the Trans-Pacific Partnership, wouldn't allow it at all, as well as the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. They are both virtually equally destructive. The Pentagon is bracing for a public dissent over climate and emergency shocks. So says Ahmed from The Guardian. The National Security Agency is motivated in part by fears that environmentally linked disasters could spur anti-government activism. Irrefutable proof we are all being sprayed with poison. 571 tons of toxic lead in chemtrails into America's sky every year. Mike Adams, Natural News. And in developing world, pollution kills more than disease. From our special reports today, public health is the epidemic of sudden infant deaths, a medically caused syndrome. Dr. Kelly Brogan, board-certified physician, and Sayer G. of GreenMedInfo show you the facts, and they are startling. Also, the government does not want you to know how the cops are tracking you. By Trevor Tim, thought the National Security Agency was bad? Local police and the Obama administration are hovering cell phone location data from inside your house, and a crackdown could lead to surveillance reform. We have a lot to share, and more, so let's take a look at what's important. First, we always start with health and nutrition. It is my contention that grapes, and grape seed, and grape skin, grape juice, grape concentrate, grape powders, and eating grapes are one of nature's most 10 perfect foods. Organic, because they spray it a lot. This is from the University of Miami, and this was done in association with the Association for Research and Vision in Ophthalmology and at the University of Miami. Here's what it says. New research suggests that regular grape consumption may play a role in eye health by protecting the retina from deterioration. Specifically, a grape-enriched diet resulted in a protective effect on retinal structure and function. Good. Now, I'm sure many of you know already that the retina is the part of the eye that contains the cells that respond to light. These are called photoreceptors. Now, there are two types of photoreceptors, rods and cones. And retinal degenerative diseases affect over 5 million people in the United States. It's the number one cause of blindness. This is due to photoreceptor cell death. And so in this study, they found that when you're taking in grapes, you are lessening this from happening. So eat more grapes, drink more organic grape juice or grape concentrate. Any of those will help you. Cell phones are a problem. I now have 41 studies, independent studies showing the danger of cell phones. This is the latest from the Times of India. This is from the State University of New York at Stony Brook, from a professor of clinical pediatrics, Mary Cataletto, Quote, do not let your kids use mobile phones for a long time, as metals used in manufacturing cell phones such as nickel and chromium may induce skin allergies. Called allergic contact dermatitis, their prolonged cell phone exposure can cause dermatitis of the face, the neck, the hands, and the interior thighs, common places were exposed to cell phones. Quote, with the rising use of cell phones and other mobile devices, pediatricians can expect to see additional cases. There was also a research team from the Jacob Thiessen of Copenhagen University Hospital, and they found it to be similar. So it's not only the electromagnetic pulses that are bad for your brain and cells and DNA, shortening the telomeres, causing your cells to explode in your brain. It's now you're also getting allergic reaction. This is published in the peer-reviewed Journal of Pediatric Allergy, Immunology, and Pulmonology. You've all seen them, the indoor tanning salons. Not good for you. Here's the latest published in the peer-reviewed Journal of the National Cancer Institute from the University of Minnesota. Quote, people sometimes use indoor tanning in the belief that this will prevent burns when they tan outdoors. However, indoor tanning raises the risk of developing melanoma, even if a person has never had burns from either indoor or outdoor tanning. So keep in mind that you could end up with melanoma from indoor tanning. Most people today, if they're educated, conscientious consumers, know that there are a lot of chemicals in our environment in many of the products we use every day without even thinking that they could be leaching into our food. Heat is the big culprit. When you boil plastic bottles to sterilize them, you also release a lot of the toxins. This is from the Simon Fraser University. Quote, a new study by researchers found that prenatal exposure to flame retardants can significantly lower IQ and greater hyperactivity in 5-year-old children. This was published in the Journal of Environmental Health Perspectives. They found a 1,000% increase in concentrations in early pregnancy when the fetal brain is developing, and that's big. So what is the message? The message is, if you are pregnant, use only organic. Use glass bottles, not plastic bottles. Make sure that everything that you're using in the way of fabric, frequently this fabric has fire retardant material in it. Most of the particle boards that people put into their homes are not even aware. Their cabinets, their desks, those are made from fire retardant and very toxic chemicals that outgas. That goes into your body, that goes into your blood, and that goes into the fetus. That's all toxic. So use organic materials, green materials, for all your blankets, sheets, pillowcases, mattresses, everything. University of North Carolina, from Cell Press, the journal in Transmolecular Medicine, says, toxins in the environment might make you older than your years. And I mean substantially older. Quote, the rate of physiologic or molecular aging differs between individuals in part because exposure to toxins, environmental factors that affect aging. And that's from Professor Norman Sharpless, University of North Carolina. Quote, we believe that just as an understanding of carcinogens has informed cancer biology, so will an understanding of these toxins benefit the study of aging. Now, what they go on to say and just lay language here is that we all live in toxic environments to one degree or another. And we have to understand, do we adapt to that environment? And if so, what is the cost of the adaptation? I just recall two streets I was recently on. One when I was lecturing in Florida. And I'm sorry I don't announce the lectures, but they're always packed. And the people who invite me in say, you know, we're full, so don't mention on the radio because we can't handle people. We don't want to turn anyone away at the door. I said, fine. But after I went for a walk on Lincoln Road, in my opinion, the most beautiful single street in America, and it was clean, trees, waterfalls, ponds, wonderful shops, dozens of restaurants. It's about seven blocks, and it's filled with thousands of people just enjoying life. And no graffiti, no smudge, no grudge. And in the early in the morning, you'll see that people out there cleaning down everything. And then the people going in about 6 o'clock and grooming everything, snipping, cutting, and flowers everywhere, aromas. The week before, I'd been in Manhattan, and I was walking from our office on the Upper West Side, walked over to Amsterdam. I wanted to walk down to Lincoln Center. Instead of walking down Broadway, I walked down Amsterdam, which is one block over. And I just stopped in the middle of the block between 83rd and 82nd, because there's a very popular vegan restaurant on 82nd and Amsterdam. And there are lots of restaurants, I think 6 restaurants just on that one block on one side of the street. There was garbage bags piled up about 4 foot high on the left side, a little space to walk through. It stunk to high heavens. The buildings were all clear down Amsterdam. They're just grungy, dirty, filthy, disgusting, maximally scuzzed. There was no aestheticism at all. It was noisy, and it was humid, and hence the air was, you could taste and smell the pollutants from the traffic. Yet, people were sitting in the outdoor cafes, enjoying themselves, enjoying each other's company, and they had become oblivious to this. Now, that's how we can maladapt to an environment. And unless someone sets a standard and then maintains that standard, everything always goes down. That's why people rarely ask themselves, what is the long-term sustainability of what I'm doing? What's it going to take to service what I'm doing, maintain what I'm doing, whether it's my body, my brain, my career, my relationship, my home, my lawn? And the more things you put into your life, the more responsibilities you have, the less time you have for yourself. More often, things start to deteriorate. It's just this idea that, wow, if we have a choice of environments, look at the difference when we're exposed to something we're not used to. Something that just kind of takes our breath away, that wow factor. And then look at how often we end up accepting all the pollutants and grime and smells and hecticness because we think we can change it. We can, we should, or we become a part of it. Can Tai Chi slow the aging process? China Medical University Hospital in Taiwan did a study, and it was published in Cell Transplantation, and they found the answer is yes. A year-long study, a cross-sectional study comparing rejuvenating and anti-aging effects among 3 groups of volunteers, found that Tai Chi, a very soft, slow-motion martial arts meditation, actually de-stresses the body, and the process of de-stressing it improved CD34 plus cell count and immune count, and that's good. So by doing Tai Chi, T-A-I-C-H-I, you can slow down the aging process. And finally, 5 foods to keep your eyes healthy. And these are simple. These are rich in antioxidants and beta-carotenes. And spinach, believe it or not, it's right at the top of the list. Watercress is right up there. Carrots are also right up there. But people don't think about watermelons. You should. They're very rich in lycopene, as are tomatoes. So some foods that we should be having more often, and that would help us improve our vision. I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today. We have a lot to share. Today is commentary day. Lots of commentaries. And then I'll have an opportunity for the people in the audience to call in and share their points of view, their questions and issues little later on. We're going to go to some of the environmental issues that are important to us today. And the first one comes from Stephen Lee of Interpress. And here's what it says. This is from Oxbridge, Canada. It says, in developing world, pollution kills more than disease. Now, imagine that. You would have thought heart disease, diabetes, stroke would be the top three. No, it's pollution. Pollution, not disease, is the biggest killer in the developing world. How many people each year die because of pollution? 8.4 million people. That's a new analysis. That's almost three times the deaths caused by malaria, 14 times that caused by other major conditions. Quote, toxic sites, along with air and water pollution, impose a tremendous burden on the health system in developing countries. Air and chemical pollution is growing rapidly in these regions, and when the total impact on the health of people is also considered, the consequences are dire. All right, now I read the whole article, and it was presented by Professor of Environmental Health at City University of New York. And here's the takeaway message, because it can be a little complex, because you can't just focus upon toxic contaminated sites with lead, mercury, and hexavalent, chromium, and obsolete pesticides. You have to look at the reality. Right now, all over the world, including in the United States, you have a push to grow the economy. Our entire basis for our capitalist system is growth. Now, I'm opposed to that. I'm not opposed to people being able to have wealth accumulated. It's theirs. That's fine. What I'm opposed to is that it's non-sustainable. There's lack of any sense of fairness in it. And yet, when you go back to the 1940s and 50s and up to about 1975, there was a forced fairness. You didn't have such extremes between those who ran industries and those who were employed for their life in an industry. There was a quality of life, a standard of living, savings, real wealth, and that made a difference. There was little debt, there were no credit cards. That made a huge difference. Our net savings at that time were about 13%. The net savings during the Great Depression was as high as 30%, and that was because people didn't have anyone they could rely upon, except charity from churches and some government agencies. But more often than not, they had to save. It's no different than the Chinese. The Chinese had the highest net savings in the world. At one time, it was over 40%. Now it's down around 29%. The Indians were behind them because no one was going to take care of you when you got older except your family. So you had to make sure you had money saved for this. But Americans went on a spending binge in the 1980s, 90s, and up to about 2006. And we were negative savings 2%. So if the average person were out without work for a week, they would be in financial crisis. That's perfect for the finance companies and the banks because they make more money when you don't make a timely payment of 18% to 20%. Instead, you could be kicked up on a debit card to 200%. And payday loans were as high as 400%. So the worse your credit, the better it is for people to exploit it. So when I look at this, I'm looking at how did we get to where we're at and what does all this mean? And what it means is that if we're not growing, then our society will begin to feel that somehow we're no longer the leading engine of commerce. And indeed, this year, China will overtake the United States. At the same time, imagine if your model was not based upon growth, but rather quality of life. Meaning, are we creating a better quality of life? Are we nurturing the soil? Are we going to smaller farming units? Are we re-industrializing small communities? Are we de-ghettoizing those communities? Are we going back to quality education, public education? Are we going back to shrinking government agencies and bureaucracies, A, to where they no longer threaten the American public, like the national security agencies, national defense agencies, and are we shrinking down the American medical complex where you can have a dual system? Those who want private insurance, private doctors, good. You're right. Have it. Pay for it. But for everyone else who wants a single-payer system, then we should have that as well. So nobody has to go without help, nor anyone should be forced to take one, which is unconstitutional. So you see, everything is actually integrated together. And what we need to do is we need to stop long enough to take a look at where we are at and how we got there. And I believe now is the time to do that. We have all these chemicals. The chemicals are causing pollution. The industries in Brazil, India, China are going full steam ahead. They're opening up a new power plant every 3 weeks in China, coal power. They are trying to work on solar, but right now it's going to be gas, oil, nuclear, and coal. Wave power, geothermal power, non-polluting energies are still for the future. As a result, China has about 1 million of its citizens die every year from pollution that it knows it's creating. That's just air pollution. That does not tell you how many people are dying from intestinal diseases from polluted water or from heavy metal toxicity from the air particulates going onto the soil. Also, China's such a backward country on so many levels. It uses human sludge. Man, the last thing in the world you want to do is grow anything in human sludge, human manure. The heavy metals, the chemicals, they're all in there, and those do not biodegrade down. They can end up the food you eat. So certified organic local farming. In other words, we should start to decentralize our society. If you haven't seen the dangers of overconcentration of power, then take a look around. We should go back to community-based, state-based power, and I hope at some point we're wise enough to do that. In any case, in all these countries that keep pushing the throttle, they also have to destroy nature. If you want to have more people living at a higher quality of life, what you call higher quality of life, then you want to give them meat and eggs and dairy and pork. To do that, then you have to clear land. You have to grow genetically engineered soybeans. You have to destroy rainforest in South America. You have to destroy hardwood forest that were carbon sinks that were there for thousands of years to ship to Japan and China for that standard of living. You see, it's a catch-22. The current economic model is non-sustainable. Now try telling someone who has all the money they'd ever need, who has every pleasure in the world, every gadget, someone to do everything for them, can fly in their own private jets, and then ask them, could they live a simpler life? And they'll look at you and say, why should I? As if they can afford any crisis of the future, but they have no compassion for those who can't, least off the 8 million people who die because of their non-sustainable economic models. I've been asked many times to do programs on chemtrails, and we have. You can go to the archives of the Progressive Radio Network and see when we do a program on a controversial issue, we always look for the scholars, the people who've done their homework and have a reputation at stake. So when we have them on, we then look at their research and we independently verify it. And indeed, the people who are talking about chemtrails were correct for a long time. What they have been incorrect more often than not is why. It's not a depopulation scheme. You give these bureaucrats far more credit. But there is irrefutable proof that we are being sprayed with poison. Now, Mike Adams of Natural News did the research to find out how much of these toxic heavy metals are being burned in what is called AV gas. AV gas means aviation gas. That's the fuel that powers most piston-driven aircraft, anything with a propeller. Now, a grand total of 571 tons of lead, that's just one mineral, are dumped each year into the air over our heads from aircraft alone. And that is from the EPA. Now, according to Mike, the scientific paper entitled Lead and Halogen Contamination from Aviation Fuel Additives at Brackett Airfield did the studies. They found chromium, bromide, and lead in the AV gas liquids. And at high parts. For example, 40 parts per million of lead, that's very high, and 605 parts per million of chlorine, that's high. Now, lead is a highly toxic heavy metal that causes bone disease, brain damage, and cancer. Chlorine is a highly reactive chemical with powerful oxidative properties. And how much lead is being chemtrailed across America due to aviation fuel? According to General Aviation News, 681,000 gallons, every day are burned. Now, let's do the math. When you look at aviation gas, and you look at 681,000 gallons, then the math is simple. AV gas weighs approximately 6 pounds per gallon. That means 4 million pounds of gas is burned each day, or 1.8 million kilograms per day. If lead is 48 parts per million in AV gas, that means that each kilogram, 2.2 pounds of AV gas contains 40 milligrams of lead. Multiplied by the 1.8 million kilograms of AV gas burned each day, this means that AV gas fuel is emitting 86.4 kilograms of lead every day in the skies over our head. And over the year, that's 331,536 kilograms of lead dumped directly into our air. And that lead falls out of the sky onto our farmland soils, our forests, our lakes, our rivers, children's playgrounds, cattle ranches, and so forth. Now, the National Emissions Inventory says that lead emissions are even higher than what I just gave you. Quote, they say 964 tons of lead put in the air per year. So, we took the lead out of gasoline, and we should have. And that was a good thing. So when are we going to stop poisoning our skies? You should be outraged, and you should be telling your legislator, stop all chemtrail research testing. But you see, I've mentioned many times, some people get it, some are challenged by it. I'll give you an example from science. There was a very good study showing that vitamin C at high dose was able to lessen the instance of a cancer in the body. At the time, I was working with the highest doses of anyone ever on the planet, with persons with advanced cancer and a group of doctors who were working with me. And we found it didn't matter what kind of cancer a person had, they improved. And that was also true for the over 1,300 people I work with who had full-blown AIDS and saved a lot of lives. They were using amounts that no doctor had ever given before. So my question was, if you're saying that vitamin C could prevent one type of cancer, why not look at all cancers? And they would not make any guess at all because their research was on one thing only. But the same principle could have been applied to all other cancers, but they chose not to do that. That is the fractionalization of science. And almost everything in our society is fractionalized, where we don't see the big picture. We see only the little tiny piece of the puzzle that we're a part of. So we have to pull back at everything and look at the larger picture. And once you look at the larger picture, you start to see how everything is interconnected. And that is what's important. But let me just give you another example, and I think it's important. This is from John Pilger from The Guardian. And it really ties in with what's going on right now in Iraq. And everything going on in Iraq, we created. And you don't see anyone in the media taking responsibility for this. Quote, the dust in Iraq rolls down the long roads that are the desert's fingers. It gets in your eyes and nose and throat. It swirls in markets and school playgrounds, consuming children kicking a ball. And it carries, according to Dr. Jawal Al-Ali, quote, the seeds of our death. An internationally respected cancer specialist at the Sadr Teaching Hospital in Basra, Dr. Ali, told me that in 1999, and today his warning is irrefutable, before the Gulf War, quote, we had two or three cancer patients a month. Now, we have 35 dying every month. Our studies indicate that 40% of the population in that area will get cancer in 5 years' time to begin with, then long after. That's almost half the population. Most of my family have it, and we have no history of cancer. It's like Chernobyl here. The genetic effects are new to us. The mushrooms grow huge. Even the grapes in my garden have mutated and cannot be eaten. End quote. Along the corridor, Dr. Janan Hassan, a pediatrician, kept a photo album of the children she was trying to save. Many had neuroblastoma. Quote, before the war, we saw only one case of this unusual tumor in 2 years. Now we have many cases with families that had no history. I've studied what happened in Hiroshima. The sudden increase of such congenital malformations is the same. End quote. Among the doctors I interviewed, there was little doubt that the depleted uranium shells used by the Americans and British in the Gulf were the cause. A U.S. military physicist assigned to clean up the Gulf War battlefield across the border in Kuwait said, quote, each round fired by an A-10 Warthog attack aircraft carries 4,500 grams of solid uranium, while over 300 tons of depleted uranium was used. It was a form of nuclear warfare, end quote. Now, though the link with cancer is always difficult to prove absolutely, the Iraqi doctors argue, quote, the epidemic speaks for itself. The British oncologist, Dr. Carol Sikora, chief of the World Health Organization's cancer program in the 1990s, wrote in the British Medical Journal, quote, requested radiotherapy equipment, chemotherapy drugs, and analgesics are consistently blocked by the United States and British advisors. We were specifically told by the World Health Organization not to talk about the whole Iraq business. The World Health Organization is not an organization that likes to get involved in politics, end quote. Recently, Hans van Spanik, former Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations and senior UN humanitarian official in Iraq, wrote to me, quote, the U.S. government sought to prevent weapons of the World Health Organization from surveying areas in southern Iraq where depleted uranium had been used and caused serious health and environmental dangers. The World Health Organization report, the result of a landmark study conducted with the Iraqi Minister of Health, had been delayed, covering 10,800 households that contained, quote, damning evidence, says the minister official, of top secret that the crisis was caused by depleted uranium. Last week, the killing of 57 Iraqis in one day was a non-event compared with the murder of a British soldier in London. Yet the two atrocities are connected. Their emblem might be a lavish new movie of F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby. Two of the main characters, as Fitzgerald wrote, quote, smashed up things and creatures and retreated back into their money or their vast carelessness and let other people clean up the mess. The mess left by George Bush and Tony Blair in Iraq is a sectarian war, and bombs of 7x7 and now a man waving a bloody meat cleaver, it's all interconnected, end quote. So when you pull back and you see that what is happening today is called blowback, we predicted in depth on this program that the day would come when the United States had left the country, and then you have unleashed a bloody sectarian battle that will not be resolved except by those who are engaged in it. When they feel that one or the other side has gained a power position, then they will negotiate. Until that time, it will not be negotiated. And all the life that we have caused to be lost there, over a million in Iraq, you never hear them talked about as victims. And the depleted uranium, which will be there for 4 billion years, you never hear anyone talking about the unintended consequences of using weapons of mass destruction. Interesting, we invaded a country based upon Saddam Hussein having weapons of mass destruction, which he didn't, and yet we, the United States, did use weapons of mass destruction. We used depleted uranium, and that is a weapon of mass destruction. But again, you can only understand that if you pull back. Today, we are run amok with ideologues or with bureaucracies that care only for their own exponential survival and growth. Long ago, we gave up being a republic or anything democratic, and I think it's time that we grew up and took a look at what we've become. In that regard, here, this is from the Guardian newspaper, from Ahmad, quote, top secret U.S. National Security Agency documents disclosed by the Guardian have shocked the world with revelations of a comprehensive U.S.-based surveillance system with direct access to Facebook, Apple, Google, Microsoft, and other tech giants. New Zealand court records suggest that data harvested by the National Security Agency PRISM system has been, not prison, PRISM, P-R-I-S-M, have been fed into the Five Eyes Intelligence Alliance, whose members include UK, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. But why have Western security agencies developed such an unprecedented capacity to spy on their own domestic populations? This is where it gets interesting. Since the 2008 economic crash, security agencies have increasingly spied on political activists, especially environmental groups, on behalf of corporate interest. This activity is linked to the last decade of U.S. defense planning, which has been increasingly concerned by the risk of civil unrest at home triggered by catastrophic events linked to climate change, energy shocks, or economic crisis, or all three. Just last month, unilateral changes to the U.S. military laws formally granted the Pentagon extraordinary powers to intervene in a domestic emergency or civil disturbance. Quote, federal military commanders have the authority in extraordinary emergency circumstances where prior authorization by the president is impossible and duly constituted local authorities are unable to control the situation to engage. Okay, there it is. Other documents show that, quote, extraordinary emergencies the Pentagon is worried about include social disorder, environmental disorders. So anything happens, they can take control. But that's what they're fearing. They're fearing the public will have a backlash. That's one. Separately, this is from Noam Chomsky from Alternet. This is short, but I thought important that we hear from what Mr. Chomsky has to say. It's called, the title of his article is The Surveillance State Beyond Imagination is Being Created in One of the Freest Countries in the World. Quote, in the past several months, we have been provided with instructive lessons on the nature of state power and the force that drive state policy. And on a closely related matter, the subtle, differentiated concept of transparency. The source of the instruction, of course, is the trove of documents about the National Security Agency surveillance system released by the courageous fighter for freedom, Edward Snowden, expertly summarized and analyzed by his collaborator, Glenn Greenwald, in his new book, No Place to Hide. The documents unveil a remarkable project to expose to state scrutiny vital information about every person who falls within the grasp of the Colossus. In principle, every person linked to the modern electronic society. Nothing so ambitious was imagined by the dystopian prophets of grim totalitarian world ahead. It is of no slight import that the project is being executed in one of the freest countries in the world and in radical violation of the U.S. Constitution's Bill of Rights, which protects citizens from, quote, unreasonable searches and seizures and guarantees the privacy of their, quote, persons, houses, papers, and effects. Much as government lawyers may try, there is no way to reconcile these principles with the assault on the populations revealed in the Snowden documents. It is also well to remember that defense of the fundamental right to privacy helped to spark the American Revolution. In the 18th century, the tyrant was the British government, which claimed the right to intrude freely into the homes and personal lives of American colonists. Today, it is the American citizen's own government that aggregates to itself this authority. Britain retains the stance that drove the colonists to rebellion, though on a more restricted scale as power has shifted in world affairs. The British government has called on the National Security Agency, quote, to analyze and retain any British citizen's mobile phone, fax, emails, IP addresses, and swept up by its dragnet, end quote. That's the Guardian was able to get that from Snowden. British citizens, like other international customers, will also doubtless be pleased to learn that the National Security Agency routinely receives or intercepts routers, servers, and other computer network devices reported from the United States. As the Colossus fulfills its visions, in principle, every keystroke might be sent to President Obama's huge expanding database in Utah. In other ways, too, the constitutional lawyer in the White House seems determined to demolish the foundations of our civil liberties. The principle of the presumption of innocence, which dates back to the Magna Carta 800 years ago, has long been dismissed to oblivion. Recently, the New York Times reported the anguish of a federal judge who had to decide whether to allow the force feeding of a Syrian prisoner who is on a hunger strike to protest his imprisonment. No anguish was expressed over the fact that he had been held without trial for 12 years in Guantanamo, one of the many victims of the leader of the free world, who claims the right to hold prisoners without charges and to subject them to torture. These exposures lead us to inquire into state policy more generally and the factors that drive it. The received standard version is that the primary goal of policy is security and defense against enemies. The doctrine at once suggests a few questions. Security for whom and defense against which enemies? The answers are highlighted dramatically by the Snowden revelations. Policy must assure the security of state authority and concentrations of domestic power, defending them from a frightening enemy, we the people, domestic population, which can become a greater danger if not controlled. It has long been understood that information about the enemy makes a critical contribution to controlling it. In that regard, Obama has a series of distinguished predecessors, though his contributions have reached unprecedented levels, as we have learned from the work of Snowden, Greenwald, and a few others. To defend state power and private economic power from the domestic enemy, those two entities must be concealed, while in sharp contrast, the enemy must be fully exposed to state authority. The principle was lucidly explained by the policy intellectual Samuel P. Huntington, who instructed us that, quote, power remains strong when it remains in the dark. Exposed to the sunlight, it begins to evaporate. Huntington added a crucial illustration in the words, quote, you may have to sell in such a way as to create the misimpression that it is the Soviet Union that we are fighting. That is what the United States has been doing since the Truman Doctrine at the outset of the Cold War. Huntington's insight into state power and policy was both accurate and prescient. As he wrote these words in 1981, the Reagan administration was launching its war on terror, which quickly became a murderous and brutal terrorist war, primarily in Central America, but extending well beyond that to Southern Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. From that day forward, in order to carry out violence and subversion abroad, or repression and violation of fundamental human rights at home, state power has regularly sought to create the misimpression that it's the terrorist that we are fighting, that they are the other option. Options such as drug lords, mad mullahs, seeking nuclear weapons, and others who seek to attack us. Throughout, however, the basic principle remains. Power must not be exposed to sunlight. In brief, there has been complete transparency for the population, but none for the powers that must defend themselves from this fearsome internal enemy. End quote. Noam Chomsky. Time for TalkBack, your opportunity to call in and share your points of view. 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. And before we take that break and come back for your calls, I have one more to share with you. And this is from Tyler Durden, Zero Hedge, quote, across America, police departments are quietly preparing for war. Quote, at first blush, the title of this post could be perceived as something hyperbolic by those who still have an impression of America's police departments as bastions of safety designed to protect and serve the people in the land of the free. However, said impressions would be promptly washed away upon reading an article in today's New York Times, which, citing Pentagon data, reveals that under the Obama administration, quote, police departments have received tens of thousands of machine guns, nearly 200,000 rounds of ammunition magazines, thousands of pieces of camouflage, night vision equipment, and hundreds of silencers, armored cars, and aircraft, end quote. Which begged the question, just who is America's police force? And by extension, the Obama administration, which is behind this quiet militarization of local police forces with weapons that would normally be seen in a war zone, who's it preparing war against? And while we're already documented America's conversation to a turnkey totalitarian banana republic, behold America's conversion to a police state. In the past, we've occasionally covered the slow but sure conversion of America's police into an army, fully loaded with the latest weapons and equipment, not even not even we had an idea the full extent of what was going to be behind the scenes. As the New York Times describes, all of the above-mentioned equipment, quote, has been added to the armories of police departments that already look and act like military units. Police SWAT teams are now deploying tens of thousands a year, increasingly, for routine jobs. Masked, heavily armed police officers in Louisiana raided a nightclub. And they did the same in California because a woman was late on her student loans. In one case, they sent a SWAT team as a part of a liquor inspection. In Florida, officers in SWAT gear with guns drawn carried out raids in barber shops because one of the people was a barber that didn't have a shown license on the wall. So you now need 10 guys ready to blow anyone's head off, and they will in a heartbeat. These guys are robots. They don't think. They'll kill anyone at any time if they have any provocation, and have done so. So now if you don't have a barbershop license posted on the wall, that's grounds for a SWAT team? Surely in an age when the National Security Agency managed to eradicate all terrorism, oh, except for the Boston bomber, the mantra that a weapon unused is a useless weapon has never rang more true. But dispatching cracked police teams to handle rogue barbers, sadly, that may be just the harbinger of the crackdowns U.S. police state will unleash shortly on anyone even the least bit guilty of violating some law or regulation, or even suspected to have, even with no proof. Or maybe completely innocent, just guilty of sparking someone's curiosity. Meet the new normal SWAT. New, improved, and, well, everywhere. The number of SWAT teams has skyrocketed since the 1980s. According to the latest study from the Professor Peter Kraska of the Eastern Kentucky University, who did the research, the ubiquity of the SWAT team has changed not only the way officers look, but also the way departments view themselves. Recruiting video feature clips of officers storming into homes with smoke grenades, firing automatic weapons. In Springdale, Arkansas, a police recruiting video is dominated by SWAT clips, including officers throwing flash grenade into a house and creeping through a field in camouflage. The rationale for the weaponization of the U.S. police force is simple. It's yours if you want it. It's also free. The Pentagon program does not push equipment onto local departments. The pace of transfers depends upon how much unneeded equipment the military has and how much the police request. So police chiefs say their choice is often easy. Ask for free equipment that would otherwise be scrapped, or look for money in their budgets to buy some. In the meantime, this is where the buildup is. Congress created the military transfer program in the 1990s when violent crime plagued America's cities and the police felt outgunned by drug gangs. Today, crime has fallen to its lowest level in a generation. The wars have been wound down. And despite current fears, the number of domestic terrorist attacks has declined. So they're adding more firepower at a time when they should be doing less. The police in 38 states have received silencers, which soldiers use to muffle gunfire during raids and sniper attacks. End quote. And yet there are people who believe none of this is real. It is. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us today. I'm Gary Nall. Let's go to the calls, and let's say hello to Harvey from Berkeley, California. Hi, Harvey.
Hi, Gary. Thanks for the show. I always listen and appreciate your advice. I want to talk about single payer, another reason for single payer. You might have mentioned it. I don't know, but to me it's really important. It's about plagues, pandemics. You know, right now we have a whooping cough outbreak. There's Ebola. All these these viruses and deadly diseases that are, due to global warming, they're starting to move around the world. And, you know, like when people feel sick up in Canada where they have single payer, they think, oh, I'm not feeling good, I got to go to the doctor or the hospital. They check in right away. Here, you know, because we have a large number of uninsured people and people are thinking, oh, well, I can't go, but they'll raise my premiums, I can't miss a day's work. And there's more of a chance of spreading of epidemics and pandemics under this system than there is under single payer. So, and even the rich people are thinking, well, I got my insurance, you don't have yours, good luck. But they're as vulnerable as the weakest link. So I'm calling for single payer to help slow down pandemics and epidemics in America.
That's a different perspective, Harvey, and I appreciate that. I would add this. I believe that what we should have is a dual system. Therefore, people who want to go to their so-called best doctor can. They pay for it, or they get private insurance to do so. But I also believe that we should take the politics and take the profits out of public service hospitals, meaning you cap what people can make, you bring in medications or medical procedures at the generic price, and by doing that, not having excessive defensive medicine, you would save one half of our medical bill, which would be about $1,600,000,000,000 a year. So we'd be saving money and having more people able to be helped, because keeping in a bed longer in a hospital, charging them $1,000, $2,000 a day for that, plus the procedures, simply wouldn't be an option. If you wanted that, then fine. Go to a private hospital, pay whatever you want, or your insurance pays for it. But that should not be dominant. A public program, a single payer, should be. Thank you, Harvey.
Thank you, Gary.
Let's say hello to George from Connecticut. Hi, George.
Hi, Gary. I'm just reflecting on your police state situation to more or less underline what you're saying. If people don't get organized, that there's a real danger that they're going to be victims of the system. I was an activist trying to help people, and when I became too useful to the people, they tried to bribe me, and when I wouldn't bribe off, they sent a police officer to my house, a high-ranking police officer, and when I had the chutzpah to find out after he threatened me and my wife right in front of us, I found out who he was. They sent the goon squad in to try to kill me, and while I was taking a bath, and try to electrocute me in my bath, and you couldn't do anything about it because they just have the blue wall of silence. They can get away with anything. They can do anything they want. And people supporting police carte blanche without basically saying, well, what are they doing and what are they getting away with? Are we supporting a blue mafia, or are we supporting people that are defending our interests or some other interests?
Interesting point. I can't comment on your own personal experience, but I will tell you that I have a lot of police officers and people in different divisions of the law enforcement who agree that they have been militarized, agree that the government has dominant control, and that when you're a national security agency or homeland security, that trumps any local authority. And so they've created a power structure. We have 16 intelligence agencies. We don't need 16. In one case, one audit showed that 10 different companies were doing the same identical work, and it cost us over $1 billion a year. When I say that we have massive corruption through our entire state, local, and federal government systems, we do. The trouble is, we pay for it, not just in the loss of our freedom, but we pay their bills. And I believe that we should only have government that is there to serve the public interest and to protect us, and that would reduce the size of government by 50%. But we are not even able to have that conversation because of too much vested interest in different groups that are not going to give up the power. The private contractors not going to give up the privatization of these outsourced. And then so we continue to be motivated by fear. So I thank you for sharing your points of view. One last quick one. We'll say hello to Don from New Jersey. Hi, Don. Don's not there, so we'll say hello. We'll say hello to Bill from New Jersey.
Gary, I've been listening for 21 years. And really listening for the last 10, I'm a very happy vegan and healthy in my upper 60s. My mom has cancer. I'm looking into fermented wheat germ extract as a cancer fighter, immune enhancer. I see it doesn't go well with vitamin C, which, of course, I'm a very, very big fan of. What is your take on it, fermented wheat germ extract, Gary?
I have not seen the research to support the... I'm getting an echo feedback from my engineer. So my engineer cut that. Thank you. I have not seen the research to support it. I do not believe that we should approach cancer from a single supernutrient. There is no single supernutrient for cancer. What you should do to see how important all the different foods, juices, and holistic therapies are is to consult with a holistic oncologist. There's Dr. Slazo. He's a medical doctor, board certified in oncology, and he's holistic. You have people like this, Nicholas Gonzalez, the same. You have people who are specialists who can guide you, and then get yourself a local nutritionist who can help make the selections for you, or your mother in this case. But don't look at one nutrient, and certainly not the modified wheat germ. I have not seen the research on. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for calling in and sharing. Tonight, 7 p.m., Dynamite 1 Hour is coming up. 30-year veteran, top economist at the World Bank, is going to tell you about corruption inside the World Bank and how they've been behind many of the civil wars and conflicts, including in the Ukraine and other parts around the world. It's the highest-ranking person that I'm aware of that's spoken out and has the facts to back it up after a 30-year career at the World Bank. You won't want to miss that 7 o'clock. Let's say to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. Yeah, a lot of people have been emailing me about the situation in Iraq. We created it, and now our gas prices are doubling practically from last year. So this is the beginning of the downfall, I guess. Anyway, I got an email here from Tom from Montville, and he said, I saw you lecture 20 years ago at the Grand Ballroom at the Hyatt, and it was one of the most exciting lectures I had ever been to. And he's asking, are you ever going to go back there?
I have no idea. I get my lecture schedule over the next 12 months. I have about 100 lectures, but I'm so focused right now on finishing my films to premiere them in the early fall and in the late fall and in the early spring. I have 4 of them, and they'll all be done and all out.
Wow,
and
I have one more. I have one more from Mark, who says that his parents saw you lecture in Coral Springs, and he said you rocked and you had them laughing and jumping for 3 hours. There was standing room only. And he said, I heard that you were going to lecture again in South Beach, but I couldn't get a ticket. And this has happened before. And, of course, his question to you is, why is it that it fills up so fast and I can't get seats?
Social media.
Ah.
Long before, there's virtually no advertising except for social media and private groups, because if I go to a place, I don't have time to do any media. I just go in that day, do the lecture, and I'm out either later that night or first thing in the first light in the morning. And I remember the lecture in Coral Springs, and it was fun because it was a huge group. It was Ann Murray and Don Rickles had been there the week before, and this was a bigger crowd. There was standing room only, about 4,500 people. And we got into a rhythm and we just rolled. And that's what I like to do about it. But that's also why I don't mention any of my lectures, because they're all full. So I'm sorry, I can't get anyone in. In fact, by the time I hit the ground, I'm going to the place. I don't even go to hotels. I mean, I'm there, lecture, out.
Maybe we should get those special screens that you put on back of you so people can sit outside and watch you all.
Oh, we actually did that in Austin.
There you go.
Yeah, the ballroom was so big that they did that. But what I'm finding is, Luann, I'm finding more and more people, especially young people, are wanting to get in alignment with the truth. They have this intuition that something's wrong, that they're being lied to by the media and the megalomaniacs and the narcissists, but they don't know what it is. They don't have the specifics. So I try to weave all that into the discussions so they come away feeling empowered. No lecture, no radio show, no counseling is of any value if it doesn't empower people. And that's
why I agree.
People today want empowerment. And I'm happy about that. And a lot of baby boomers want to start their lives over. They want to be rejuvenated, and that's good too. Thank you, Luann.
You're welcome.
Let's say hello now to Utrecht Lead. Hi, Utrecht.
Hi, Gary. Today we're talking about Iraq, an ancient land, a modern catastrophe.
Good. Utrecht Lead right now. Please stay with us.